This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We live in a hyper-connected age. The internet, satellite TV, and mobile phone technology make it possible for us to share information, ideas, and culture with people from all over the world. At least that's the potential and the hope.
But our next guest says there's a central paradox here. While it's easier than ever before to share information and perspectives, many of us are actually getting a much narrower view of the world than we did when we were less connected. Even though we have the potential to interact with a much wider world, we tend to use the internet, search engines, social media to reach out to a world and people we already know.
MIT's Ethan Zuckerman says, instead of being true cosmopolitans, we've created a world of imaginary cosmopolitanism. And that's a problem, because we're living in a world with big global changes, which demand truly global solutions.
Ethan Zuckerman is director of MIT's Center for Civic Media. His new book is called Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connections. In the Age of Connection, it's essentially a call to fix what's wrong with global media, the internet, education, and all the ways we connect with each other so that we can live up to the promise and potential of this hyper-connected age. And Ethan Zuckerman, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and as I said, I had to you before we were on the air, I had fun reading your book this weekend. So let's start with a case in point in sort of your argument. And this gets to sort of the heart of what we do right here at WBUR, news and information. You point out that television news in the U.S. features less than half as many international stories today as it did back in the 1970s. The same goes for printed news. What's going on here? What do you see when you look out there?
Well, it's a really interesting question. It looks like international news sort of peaked in American attention round about the middle of the Vietnam War. And it's sort of been downhill ever since. Mm-hmm. We've had waves of attention sort of come back at the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. We've had a little bit more of it. But it seems to be a combination of less audience interest and more cost for newsrooms. As NPR listeners know, it's really expensive to do the international stuff. It requires you putting reporters on the ground, having those bureaus. And we've seen, with newspapers and particularly with broadcast television, we've seen an enormous amount of cutting happening to that international news presence. I think the assumption had been, fine, we've got the internet, at least we can get whatever information we need, possibly directly from the horse's mouth. You know, maybe we'll read the Times of India, or maybe we'll read someone who's tweeting from India. But it turns out that it's not just about supply. There's an amazing amount of supply of international news and information out there, but we need someone to say, hey, this is important, you want to pay attention to that. We used to get a whole lot more of that from what I call curated media, like newspapers and broadcast. And now that we're really moving into a realm where most of our media comes via search or via social, we're getting a lot less of that international news.
Well, this is the hype that we always hear, though, about the internet, that it's a democratizing force. It's going to sort of even out those cultural differences. Everything is just a click away. That isn't the case as you look out there.
Near as I can tell, what the internet is really good at is giving us what we want. Mm-hmm. And what we want is the familiar. It's what we already know to be important. And so when we have an election, as we were just talking about here on the show, we get a ton of information about it because we know that elections are very important. We pay a lot of attention to them, particularly presidential elections. You think about some of the artifacts of our media. We cover in exquisite detail the Democratic and Republican conventions, despite the fact that we all know that absolutely no news will happen there, because we know that those are supposed to be interesting. And we pay attention to the people around us, the people who look like us, and the people who we know are powerful people. But we're at a moment in global geopolitics where change can come from any different corner. Really, no one saw Tunisia coming. Mm-hmm. And we literally weren't watching that story until almost the day that Ben Ali stepped down as president of that country, because somewhere in our media blind spots, we had a sense that North Africa just wasn't all that interesting.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the story of Tunisia, because you also wrote really interestingly, even about an event well before that, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which was sort of missed as well. And you talk about people being, or we're living in an age when it's very easy to sort of keep track of information and even secrets, but we miss the mystery. We miss what isn't obvious and apparent.
That's a phrase that I stole from Susan Landau, who's one of the very smartest people who writes about digital security of one fashion or another. And she was talking about the fact that, you know, the global intelligence establishment was paying a great deal of attention to Iran before the Islamic Revolution, but they were paying attention to it because they saw it as our stable ally in the region. And they also knew, of course, because everyone knows, that the secrets of Iran were to be held in the military bases and they were to be held, you know, in the discussions with the Shah. They weren't what was happening in the mosques or in the markets. And that's where that revolution came from. So there's always this possibility that if we're not paying attention broadly enough, that we start missing these much broader changes. The ones that aren't about secrets, you know, where are the missiles, you know, where are the troops, but the mysteries, which are, wow, there's a really fundamental social shift going on here, which we might be getting if we were getting more information, both news and social media, from different parts of the world on a more consistent basis.
Tell me another story that illustrates this problem. You travel back and forth, or at least you have gone through a period where you traveled back and forth a lot to Africa, to Ghana, right? And you've been struck by the fact of how little we know about some very big, important stories over there.
Well, this was the story that suckered me into the world of the lucrative world of media criticism. It's basically the story that ruined my life in one fashion or another. In the year 2000, I was running an NGO that was based in Ghana, and it was a technology nonprofit called Geek Corps. And the whole idea behind this nonprofit was the internet was making us borderless. It was leveling borders. There was no reason why my smart friends in Accra, Ghana, couldn't be running a great digital business and competing with the rest of the world. It was a wonderfully naive idea. And Ghana had something very exciting in 2000. They had free, fair, democratic elections that had the transfer of power. So a government that had been brought in through a coup had become more democratic over time. Opposition won, almost no violence, incredible election. Got almost no attention in the U.S. because it happened to occur right after Bush v. Gore. So I had the wonderful circumstance, my Ghanaian friends, my dear friend Kobe Kumson, who was Ghana's ambassador to the U.S. at that point, showed me the facts that he had sent to the U.S. government offering Ghanaian election observers to come oversee the U.S. election, since it was obviously going very poorly. But I started looking at this and saying, geez, I'm never going to be able to get this Ghanaian nonprofit off the ground if no one knows where Ghana is, if they don't know that it just had this incredible, you know, stable election, if they don't know that this is a great story of Africa rising. And I started looking at my role in all of this and essentially saying, I think the media is a really big piece of this. We don't get to see the world through our own eyes. We see the world through the eyes of media.
Well, make the case about why American media should have covered that story. I mean, you said it happened in the wake of Bush v. Gore. Certainly that's a story that affects, you know, the average. I mean, let's talk about Americans. You know, that affects Americans so much more directly than what's going on in a corner of Africa.
There's no doubt we should have covered Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the nice things about newspapers is that they do make it possible for us to follow multiple things at the same time. What did you miss by missing the rise of Ghana? You just missed 10 years of incredible economic growth and probably the best investment opportunity of my generation, at least, which would have been buying into the more stable African democracies over the last 10 years, during which they have emerged as having a stable middle class, and a country like Ghana's returned something like 8%, you know, year on year in investment over there. When we're not paying attention to the rest of the world, we lose out in three different ways. We lose out on the upside of positive change that we don't see happening. We can lose out on the downside of threats that we weren't expecting. And you start thinking about threats like international pandemic, like SARS or bird flu. You start thinking about giant problems that have to have a global component to solutions like global warming. The third that you end up missing, and I think this is the one that actually affects people most directly, is this question of cognitive diversity. A lot of social scientists these days are saying that one of the most important things for a workplace, for your thinking as an individual, is to get exposed to a lot of different forms of problem solving. And the real worry for me is that if we get isolated paying so much attention to our friends and family, to the stories immediately around us, we don't get that sort of rich cognitive diversity that challenges us to think in different ways.
Listeners, we're talking to Ethan Zuckerman. He's author of the book, brand new, just out today. It's just out today, right, Ethan?
That's right.
Right. It's called Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. He argues that in spite of all the ways to connect in the internet age, we're actually getting a narrower view of the world than we used to. Do you agree? And if so, why is that? What's the solution? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. There's so much that I want to talk to you about this, but let's sort of jump into some of your, you've got some great solutions. You talk about what we can do to become more digitally cosmopolitan. And one of your ideas has to do with language translation on the internet, right?
So if we want to start getting ideas from other parts of the world, one of the toughest barriers we have is language.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that despite more than 40 years of automated translation, you know, anyone who's tried to read a Chinese newspaper through Google Translate knows that you might get the gist of it, but you're probably not going to read it day to day, moment to moment. What's really interesting is that other countries are solving this problem so much better than we are. I just had the privilege of spending a couple of days at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, and I got more questions about what was going on in American TV shows than I could have possibly imagined, and in many cases shows that I don't follow. But it was really crazy to be getting questions about George R. R. Martin from Chinese audiences. And the answer is, what's happening is that Chinese audiences are taking American television shows, they're getting together to transcribe them, translate them, put subtitles on them, and then redistribute them. Now, on the one hand, this is a big problem with intellectual property, and you have a lot of people who are probably really unhappy about this form of distribution. But it's also a really interesting way for a group of people to get together and translate material and make it available. Now, flip this around. You've got roughly 450 million people online in China. I would venture to say most of us have absolutely no idea what's a trending topic on Weibo, which is Chinese version of Twitter. And to me, that seems like rather a giant blind spot. We know that China is going to become the world's largest economy. We know that we have an enormous and complicated economic relationship with them. For the most part, most of us have no idea what Chinese people, ordinary Chinese people, are talking about and doing online. So I think to one extent or another, we have to start figuring out how to get groups of people together, building some of these systems that allow us to do a better job of paying attention to what's going on in other parts of the world.
So there's another great example that you write about in China. It's called Yayon, right?
Yep.
So this is essentially what, an army of translators going to work and pretty much translating the internet there for everyone to see it?
It's spelled like Yian. My Chinese friends have finally told me that the way to pronounce it in Mandarin is Yen, which
Yen.
Just means translator.
Mm.
And what Yen is a group of about 80,000 Chinese people who coordinate online, who translate English language media into Chinese. So something like The Economist comes out, people say, here are articles that we want to see within this. They get together and they decide who's going to be the first translator, who's going to be the editor, and then they share it within the group. And so a good chunk of the New York Times, popular websites like Read Write Web, there are full Chinese versions of these that go online very soon after they're published. Now, we've tried to do very limited versions of this in the U.S. through a project called Global Voices, where we've invited people all over the world to translate from social media, try to give you some insight into what's going on. But we've never had the scale. And I think in part we've never had the scale because we haven't quite had the interest. And I feel like there's still sort of a conceptual barrier that we have to break through. It's not a hard sell right now to Chinese audiences to say there's something going on in America that you want to pay attention to. So far, it's a really hard sell to make to a U.S. audience that there's something 450 million Chinese online have to say that might be interesting.
But if we are less aware or have a narrower vision of the world than we did before all of this wonderful ability to connect electronically through the internet and the Twitterverse and everything else. Might that suggest that maybe the technology itself is, you know, doesn't have the potential to do what we think it can do and should do?
Well, it's an interesting question. The pushback that I usually get when I make a big assertion like we're getting less international news than we were 30 or 40 years ago is, well, speak for yourself. I get a ton more. You know, I go to the Times of India. I read the South China Morning Post, trying to find out about Ed Snowden. I'm reading all of these Hong Kong blogs. And that's a wonderful pushback, and it's great that people are taking advantage of those opportunities. My argument is that it may not balance out the shift in sort of broadcast media, which has been a really profound shift. But let's look a little bit at those tools, right? I'm an old internet guy. I've been online since the late 1980s, and the internet of the late 1980s was largely topic-based. We would get together on a bulletin board system called Usenet, and you would end up talking about a topic like photography, and there was a decent chance that you would interact with some of the other users of the net from other countries at that point. The topic was the main form of organization. Now let's fast forward. We've got Facebook. What's the first thing that Facebook does when you sign up for it? It combs through your email and it says, well, here are all the people that you're in regular contact with. The next thing it does is says, well, let's go back into your history. Let me reconnect you with all the people that you knew in elementary school. And so my Facebook wants to make sure that I don't lose track of a single person I went to college with, I went to high school with, all the way back to, you know, my elementary school. All of this has a way of anchoring us in these existing social networks where we start falling victim to something that social scientists called homophily, which is basically the tendency of birds of a feather to flock together. And the reason that Facebook does this is homophily's really comfortable. We really like being surrounded by people who look like us and talk like us and believe the same things. We like that sort of warm feeling. I like it too, by the way. Like, Facebook is where I turn to on those really long days where I'm in my fifth airport of the day and I just want a little support. But we don't want that all the time. And the danger is that these sites, which want us comfortable because they want us viewing ads, are interested in challenging us as little as possible. And we need to be challenged as much as we need to be comfortable. And that may be what we're losing at this moment in time.
Well, I want to talk to you about sort of what we do about that. But first, I want to invite the listeners into this conversation. We're talking to Ethan Zuckerman. He's director of MIT's Center for Civic Media. He's also author of Rewire: Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. This is essentially a call to fix what's wrong with global media, the internet, education, all the ways we connect with each other. So, listeners, what do you think? What do you think of his argument, and what do you think the solution is? 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, Ethan, what is the solution? You laid out sort of what's great and comfortable about Facebook, but clearly it's sort of causing us to sort of look inward and stay in touch with what is familiar and what we know. How do we push against that?
So we need tools that help us take risk. Mm-hmm. We need tools that help us raise our level of risk in terms of what we encounter online in the hopes that we get some serendipity, that we get the unexpected discovery of information that's really useful to us, that pushes us in some different directions. And when I say serendipity, I mean not just random information. I don't mean just picking out random stuff. I bet you didn't know this. It means looking at what you already pay attention to and then trying to figure out, can we widen your circle a little bit? If you're someone who mostly listens to liberal people from New England, can we get you to listen to some moderates from New England? Or can we get you to listen to progressives in another part of the world? If you are someone who's a person of faith, you know, can we get you listening to people who are interested in some of the same perspectives, but from a secular perspective? It's not about going at random. It's not about looking for your opposite or the hardest voice for you to hear. It's probably about looking for bridge figures, people who have sort of one leg in the world that you spend a lot of time in, and one leg in another world that's very unfamiliar to you.
I like this idea of bridge figures, and you've got some nice examples. You talk about one in particular that I wanted you to talk about, the white African, right?
This is Eric Hirschman, who's a dear friend of mine and a colleague. He is one of the founders of an amazing project called Ushahidi, which is a world-leading software company that just happens to be based in Kenya. And Hirschman developed this great reputation online for helping people sort of learn how ordinary Africans were hacking technology. Mm-hmm. He's one of the founders of a blog called AfriGadget and got a lot of people in the sort of U.S. maker scene paying attention to what African blacksmiths were doing and electronics hackers were doing. And the reason he's able to do this is he's American, but he was born and raised in South Sudan and then later in Kenya, speaks Swahili, based in the community, has great ties there, but also is an American geek and knows what that audience will relate to. So he's able to sort of serve as a tour guide to a chunk of the world that would probably remain very unfamiliar and very surprising to most of us, but he's able to bring it online and make it make sense to us.
Another one that I want you to talk very quickly about because it's just a great example, Tahani Jones, middle linebacker for the Cincinnati Bengals, who sort of takes on the globe in the offseason in a really interesting way, right?
Well, poor Tahani didn't get re-signed by the Bengals, so now he's a commentator on college football. But for 2 years, he did something great. In his offseason from the NFL, he would spend the entire summer traveling from country to country, looking at different sports, and then becoming a full participant. And so you would have this amazing American athlete go into sports that he just didn't know very well. And so he would be playing at the B level of English rugby and finding himself pushed to his limits. But what he would also find is that he was having these amazing cross-cultural encounters, whether it was in Russia, whether it was in Cambodia, all different corners of the world. Really great show and really a great example of how an interest in something like sports can open up connections to other parts of the world.
Well, let's take a couple of calls in the few minutes we have left. Rebecca is calling from Waltham. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air with Ethan Zuckerman.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm so excited to be hearing about this topic. I found that I had an experience twice living abroad in England and then in Japan as well, where I couldn't believe the news that I was hearing there that I had never heard at home, just a different perspective and what was going on. And through my travels, it continued to experience the same thing. And I'm really glad that we are talking about this.
Rebecca, thanks so much for that. Ethan, I mean, respond to what Rebecca's saying. As you travel, do you see sort of other parts of the world more kind of aware and looking outward rather than inward and using this great sort of, you know, hyper-connective technology to do what it should be done with it?
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for that observation. I think it's an experience that a lot of us have had when we have the chance to spend a bunch of time in another culture. We're doing a lot of research on this at Center for Civic Media, and we're actually doing a lot of analysis of where and what different countries pay attention to. And it turns out that pretty much everyone's a little parochial. We've all got our set of nations that we pay more attention to. It's usually our neighbors. It's usually whoever's very powerful. But this is potentially what could be so exciting about the internet. You've got that possibility of saying, hey, let's pay attention to China, but let's look at what the Japanese are saying about China. Let's look at what the Indians are saying about China. Let's look at a U.S. perspective, and let's try to figure out how we triangulate around that. My single favorite example in this is Dawood Kutab, who's a Jordanian journalist. And he realized about 15 years ago that most Arab newspapers did a terrible job of covering their own politics. Mm. But if you read the next country over's newspaper, you could get really great insights into what was going on. So if you wanted to know what was going on in Jordan, read the Lebanese newspapers. And this was something that was wonderful about the early internet. I think we need to find better and better ways to take advantage of this capability of looking through multiple sets of eyes and getting multiple perspectives, you know, on other countries in the world and also on how the rest of the world is viewing what's going on in the U.S.
And Ethan, what's the sort of goal of what you call digital cosmopolitanism? I mean, is it world peace? Is it solving hunger? Is it just to be sort of more aware?
I would actually say I think it's a lot more personal. I love to achieve any of those big goals. But more than anything else, you know, I'm interested in the limits of my own thinking about the world and sort of helping other people look at their limits. One of the things I talk about in the book is this idea of personal tracking. There's a lot of people who are tracking what they eat, how many steps they take a day, tracking your weight. I'm wondering why we aren't doing a better job of tracking what we put into our heads. And there aren't a lot of people out there who are doing the work of tracking, here's what I'm reading, here's who I'm paying attention to. And if you take seriously this idea that diversity is one of the best sources of creativity, I think the reason I'm going after this is I really want to be exposed to a lot of perspectives and a lot of ideas from different parts of the world.
Well, it's a great and provocative set of ideas. Ethan Zuckerman, he's the director of the MIT Center for Civic Media. He's the author of a new book, Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. And Ethan Zuckerman, thanks so much for coming in to talk about all this. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, the conversation continues. You can post your comments at radioboston.org.
And remember, you can always follow us at Twitter as well. We're at Radio Boston. Or if Facebook is more your style, like us. We're at facebook.com/Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.